You're currently tuned in to Anti-Blackness and COVID-19. Later in the program, we'll hear from Jodie Barney and Southeast Mutual Aid on the effects of the Victorian government's response to COVID-19 on disabled members of their communities. But first, 3CR Diaspora Blues producer Ayan Shirwa caught up with Mo Noor, an advocate for fellow residents of North Melbourne's public housing towers. It was in early July 2020 when the Victorian government deployed hundreds of police officers to detain thousands of residents in their flats in the name of COVID-19 outbreak containment. In the lead up to this, Mo was one of many community organisers warning of the dangers of COVID-19 to residents of under-resourced public housing. Mo has been vocal about the impact the government's action and inaction has had on fellow disabled and sick members of his community.
So for our listeners who don't know who you are, tell us a bit about yourself.
I'm a human centred designer. I work as a service designer now, but my community work is mostly focused around public housing policy and advocacy around health and access to affordable housing.
And how do you get into this? How did you get into community work?
It kind of was more out of necessity, to be honest. I grew up in the flats, public housing, when I was a kid. And when I was younger, I'd look around and see kind of a lot of the issues and difficulties that residents and people, and my mum's friends would have. And when I got older, around 15, 16, I started to look around hoping that there'll be people there advocating and kind of taking up the mantle to find change. And instead, I looked around, there wasn't really that many other people. So me and other peers, other Africans and other young community organisers, we started to kind of do the work, started to kind of advocate for residents, started to translate things, started to try to understand a lot about housing policy. I spent a good year or so forth at the Victorian Archives trying to understand the creation of public housing, just to understand how we got to this situation. And I've worked for a few different organisations, and it's something that I think I've continuously done more out of necessity. The goal is I hope that I can help enable change, that people like me no longer need to exist, in the sense that, you know, a lot of the issues would be resolved through policy, through grants, through government, rather than the need for that kind of action. So that's, I guess, my idealistic approach. But since then, it's just been always kind of assess and always help out and stuff. What I do for a job and what I do for community is similar. The only difference is who the clients are and the expectations. So for me, respect and kind of understanding is paramount, regardless of your ability to clearly communicate, regardless of your background, regardless of your religion or gender. So the need to continuously kind of advocate for reform was kind of important, something that I still stay true to.
How do you think the stigma around public housing influenced the hard lockdown?
Firstly, I think there has to be some clarifications I think people need to understand. You know, as a person who grew up here and left and kind of came back, not out of the need for myself, but because I have a sick mother, and, you know, my grandmother who had passed before that I had kind of cared for, there are others similar to myself that had not come back because of this wanting need, but I guess out of necessity to help our families. We were doing okay, but we didn't have the financial income to stay in the support of our families that were requiring care or saw our jobs and stuff shift. So a lot of the tower that I live in now, I know a number of friends that I went to uni with that are in similar boats. They've come back to help out their parents. They've come out to help out their siblings. They've taken reductions in hours. They've taken reductions in work to deal with the reality of just how it survives, the battles of access to NDIS, the battles to services, et cetera, et cetera. And that's compounded by cultural linguistically limitations. That's compounded by lack of access, and et cetera. Firstly, I think there has to be a clarification that this idea of where it's these uneducated individuals that reside here and have no work ethic and have no ability and are living off the government dollar is a false narrative, I think. Yes, there are some that live here. Yes, there are situations. But to say that that is the majority is a falsehood of what it really means to live in, not just public housing, but in social housing broadly. Yeah. And I think people were shocked when they found out about the lockdown. Now, to go back to your, I guess, your question about do you think that impeded the result of the government, it shocked me, to be honest, when it first resolved. I knew there were always difficulties. That was the reason people like me were back here. We were concerned that our parents were sick. We were concerned about COVID. We were concerned about pandemics. We had seen what it had done to families and our communities overseas. We were concerned with it far more than the average Victorian or Melburnian had been. People like me had been tracking COVID since November last year. We have friends and contacts who work in infectious diseases around the world. It was not something that we took very lightly, and understanding the risks that it posed. So there were conversations in the community and people who had advocated to the department earlier on in the start of the year, the need for access to hand sanitizers, the need for appropriate information, the need for situations. And nothing was done. It was this kind of eluding fear, and we had hoped that we had somehow, with the community action that was done earlier on, that we would somehow escape this, because we knew when it came, it was going to hit us, and it was going to hit us hard. The thing that shocked me the most, I guess, was the connotation and the assertion by the government for three things, and three things that till now I've yet to find or get clarification on. And others, we have had many conversations in this. But the first was the lack of actual consultation and access to testing earlier on. So to give you some context, I, who reside in one of the North Melbourne towers with my mother, the closest testing site that was offered to us here was the Royal Melbourne Hospital, which is a 15, 20-minute tram ride from where I am. That's assuming that you're able-bodied and have abilities, or a 10-minute car ride, assuming you have a car and abilities to go to it. Yeah? We have a tower that's solely dedicated to old people, Publish Street, and that is made up of people who are 50 years or older, who have impairments, have walkers and stuff like that. You basically rule them out. For people who have disabilities or impairments, you rule them out. So this connotation that the community had no access, that there was no guidance, and that on that whim, for the, I quote, the most vulnerable people in our society, to make these up-handed statements based on no real data, based on no real understanding, and then think that it was appropriate to bring the police in, as if the stigma and the perception of poverty associated with criminality, you know, boggles the mind.
Absolutely. I guess listening to you speak, Mo, I get the feeling, and I guess I also know this because I have friends who live in the same building, but one thing that people kept hammering in was that the assumption that the people in the flats were guilty, that this was a response because they were doing the wrong thing. Yeah. Can you tell me more about that?
I think the best example of that will be the first few days. So when the lockdown occurred, it was in the middle of the day with no real information or clarification. So it was people like me that started the first big channel to try to communicate to people, to family, to friends, what exactly was happening. And ironically, it was the day that I was somehow here and not visiting family or at another project or work or whatever. So I was fortunate enough to basically be here when I started to get calls and messages. And on one hand, the government stated this is for the most vulnerable people. You know, these are for whatever positions, you know, all these kind of positions. Yeah, this connotation that they're doing it on our behalf. And the other hand, when people like me started to communicate with the police that were stationed downstairs, no one had answers. They were looking to us to provide context to community. People were scared, and all you saw were police. There was no translators. There was no translated information other than what we were able to translate on the fly. There was no access to when testing would occur. There was no access to even if there were cases in the tower. So it was a shock to me to find out when I'm in lockdown that there's all these cases and no one really knew about it. It was a shock to us that they didn't even bother to tell us that. I live with my elderly mother. she has a disability. What did you think was going to, what do you think we were going to do? You know, did you think my mother was going to accost a policeman? People were begging for information. People were asking for medication for their children. People were asking for medication for their mental illnesses because it was a Saturday. People were trying to get kids that had been left with relatives here because they had gone to work. People were visiting friends. In what rational position did you think that the need of 500 police were needed? What riot did you think? What kind of weaponry did you think that people like us resided and had? I'm known for being very firm and very kind of opinionated in providing kind of context for my community and advocating. But beyond writing a barely, you know, hardly worded email, I'm struggling to kind of comprehend what I'm meant to do and respond or think about when you send me police to people who you know are vulnerable, that are scared, that are wanting information, that have little access as a first measure to get information. And then as the days progressed and as the connotations such as the letter that we received that stated, and I quote this, it gave us five positions. It said, you're going to be locked down, et cetera, et cetera. It gave you these five points. You'll be given access to appropriate medical leave. You'll be given access to appropriate medical care, et cetera, et cetera. And at the bottom, it stated, if you refuse to get testing, you will not only have to do the 14 days, which is standard, but they would penalize you an extra 10 days for refusing. They had no medical basis, and yet, till this day, have not seen it applied to anyone else. Mm-hmm. Now, to give you some context, we have people here that are nurses that were refused, allowed out, that have been tested weekly because of where they work in hospital. We have people that were in, you know, self-quarantine because they had come from overseas and had been locked in their homes for 2 weeks that were confused what was going on. We have people that, you know, had worked with certain agencies and so forth that, you know, were also self-aware of the situation. You know, and a majority of us had undertaken COVID tests prior, even with the difficulties ensued, given the situations that we live at home, given the populations that we care for, the elderly, the disabled, and the need to maintain a certain level of safety or bubble.
Mm.
So in response to all this, what we were left with was madness. It was chaos. What happened here was we were left to ourselves. And I don't say this to basically be flippant. I don't say this to provide a false sense of reality. I and many others were the fortunate few that took the lead to try to communicate and advocate for people. So in the first few days, I had people beg me for insulin. I spent 5 days trying to get my mother her medicine. I had people call me from other apartments to provide me access to basic medical care. We had lists trying to figure out where certain medications were. You know, if people had insulin, how much they had, who can communicate. I had people plead with me for food and to basic questions for neighbors that had kids who were autistic, for people who had panic disorders, for people who needed to get medical care. They were refused. There was no mechanism. So when we requested fresh air, I remember I battled this day in, day out on calls with the number, yeah, and told, no, it's not going to happen. No, you can't get it. And then to please, for on behalf of not people like myself who are fortunate, who are young still, so for please, on behalf of, you know, people my mother's age, people with disabilities, to be given 10 minutes of fresh air. Because I think people's misunderstanding of what it is to live in these towers is not, I guess, fully understood.
Yeah, can you describe...
You want me to give a perspective of, like, the apartment, I guess, or the inside and stuff, yeah?
Yeah, so if you could give us, I guess, a measurement of the apartments and so on.
Yeah, I can do that. An average room here is about the average size of a normal room. So I'd say it's about 3 meters by 2 meters, I think. Apologies for my measurement. The thing that's unique about these apartments is there are two windows in each room. The thing is, one of the windows has no opening, so it's a solid window. The second window is a French window, French-style kind of hinge, which means it hinges out about maybe 4 or 5 inches, and that's all you got. So think about this. You're in generally concrete building because it's concrete walls with concrete ceilings and concrete floors in apartments that may have, depending on the makeup of people, because some are overcrowded, but have a number of people with windows that only open about 6 inches. But you can't get fresh air because the way the window shifts means that air comes in from one of the sides of the windows. And then in front of that is a mesh screen. And that's it. Yeah? So that's your space. The windows that open up and open outwards open to the corridor, which we were told are infectious. So all those were closed. The way that people would naturally get ventilation in these apartments was through opening the main door and letting the screen door open to the corridor. Again, exposure area. So these were told closed, and we had cops walking back and forth. So you have 6 inches, 5 or 6 inches of open window that opens on an angle. So what people started to do for the first few days was literally stick their hand out of the window in the 6 inches to feel the fresh air.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible.
And it was ironically like something that a few of us had discovered as we were trying to find how to get air, because, you know, for the first few days, you start to lose it, to be honest.
How did it affect your mental well-being, Mo?
Look, I have fended calls from residents and people and others in the towers, as one of the coordinators in some of the towers, where people have begged me for medicines I do not have access to, where I have gone to battle to try to get people who are on dialysis to go to appointments and be refused. To hear stories in other towers opposite us where, you know, we had one case where it was a young woman, I think in her 1920, and she has cancer. And we were refused to get her to go to her oncology appointment. You know, I've had people plead with me, beg me, and I had nothing to offer them. It's hard to comprehend, to be honest. People like me threw ourselves into our advocacy and our, I guess, organization to somewhat stay sane, but none of us left. We appreciated all the volunteers. We appreciated the support from the organization that was happening with us. So we appreciated the volunteers that had come and sacrificed time in the command center to advocate for medicine. Because without them, we'd be lost. I have only grace and courage for people who are residents themselves, risking it all to basically door knock and provide food to residents because none was provided. And I think without the, I guess, action of those individuals, those residents inside the towers, those who were coordinating and sacrificed all outside, the Victorians that gave and provided food for those to help clean and pack, without them, we would have nothing.
It seemed like the community were the only ones that they could depend on. And just to compare your experience with mine, because I live in one of the towers, but not the towers that went under hard lockdown. So the tower that I'm in, we do have hand sanitizers and so on, but what's changed now is that we have extra security who sit outside of the lift. So when you walk out of the lift, the first thing you're met with is security and then a little desk with flyers
the concierge.
And then I had a chat with them. I was like, hey, it's good to see that, you know, you're being proactive and so on. But when do you think this will end? And they were like, we don't know. And I said, so, you know, no one's told you the end date? There's no, so you can't tell us?
No.
And they were like, no.
I'll even shock you a bit more if that's possible after all this. So the building that you live in now, yeah, Aya? the building that not just in the Nine Towers that we live in. It was after 5 days of advocacy, and I'm not saying this in the sense of like hyperbolicness or stuff like that. This is documented. It was only until the 23rd of July, a week after I had left lockdown, almost 9 days on top of that, did the Department of Human Services realize that the machines that were installed, not only in the Nine Towers, but across all the towers, were not functional and were empty, beyond the ones in the corridor downstairs, and were currently being replaced. It shouldn't shock you that a majority of the kids who live in these towers don't have access to the internet. It shouldn't shock you that we have an abundance of disabled people that did not have access as their support had ended. It should not shock you that we had a lot of people that were parents and hit by the lockdown and have now lost their jobs. I think, on one hand, it highlighted the realities that were always present. It forced people to see it. And in that sense, I think it was a needed, I think it was something small to shine a light on the reality of the situation. But in terms of my perspective on things and the wider, I guess, situation, you can't come back from this. Like, I need people to understand, and I gloss over it because these are haunting memories for people like me. You know, I think you need to understand that being locked in an apartment where your only fresh air is 6 inches, I'd like people to understand that we had friends and people who are volunteers who were inside whose entire families were COVID positive and they were negative. And we spent days trying to get them hotel quarantine and were told that they need to self-isolate. So imagine, in an apartment that only has one window that opens 6 inches in every single, like, in three of the rooms, if that's claustrophobic enough. On top of that, you may be in a household where the majority of family have COVID. You're the only COVID-safe person. You have no masks, even though you've requested it. You can't leave. And you are stuck in a single room that's no bigger than a small average room that's less than 3 by 2 meters. After 14 days, and the thing is, I think people misunderstand, it didn't just 14 days that happened. For some people, it went through their families. Some people didn't leave lockdown until August the 1st.
Wow.
And they had to walk through their entire families, watching one is each of them become close contacts and test positive and so forth like that. You know, confined in situations. And then say after that, you return to the outside world. You know, for me, the thing that broke me the most was I used to stare out the window. I remember this. When I first had returned and I was helping, you know, my grandmother many years before she passed here. We used to stare out the window and like point at things and reflect on, you know, how things had changed. The new buildings that were here, the grass, the green. So during lockdown, I tried to continue that tradition. And for me, I couldn't continue it because I would stare outside my window and I would watch people walking their dogs, going for a walk, exercising under stage 3. And inside, I am in an apartment, unable to get help for my mother, unable to help fellow residents beyond advocating for stuff, unable to get traction, hearing on the media that it is our fault. And understand this, my mother had a test prior the lockdown. She was COVID negative. I had a test prior to the lockdown. We're talking only just a week or so COVID negative. My mother was in hospital. She had another test. She was COVID negative. I've been having one once a week. We're COVID negative. During the lockdown, we had the test initially. We're COVID negative. During the end of the lockdown, we again had a test. We're COVID negative. Until now, neither me or my mother have had COVID. We have had about 4 or 5 tests between us. And yet, the only situation that deemed my mother's, I guess, imprisonment, the deemed imprisonment of my fellow kind of residents and situations, was because they resided in public housing. and to see the words of the most vulnerable people thrown on my face. When after my exit, it was left up to people like me and others to not only deal with the trauma, but basically go to war with the department to try to get hand sanitizer, not only for ourselves, not only for the Nine Towers, but for the wider housing estate, to basically argue, till now, to understand cleaning schedules so it's not repeated, to advocate with government and others to not repeat this lesson, hence it was not, because it wasn't shown successful. And at the end of all of this, nothing.
And how are you dealing with the trauma, Mo? What's been your source of strength? How are you, you know, getting by each day?
I think I can only speak for the fellow kind of coordinators and myself. So we're weird, yeah? We're residents, but we were the ones running around and arguing. So we saw not only the impacts on our families, but we saw the impacts of others, and then we advocated afterwards and stuff like that. So we're a weirdly a crazy bunch, yeah? With a few of them getting COVID themselves, unfortunately. And for myself, I don't know, man. I really don't know. I think you try to transition back into the world, yeah? You try to not let it kind of, like, define you and stuff. But then you were haunted by it, you know? Every time I hear a siren, because our apartment's on the main road, we all wake up and everyone starts calling each other. I fear the police. And I don't think people understand what that means. I mean, I viscerally fear the police now. I am so scared every time I walk past a police car, every time I see a police officer, every time I see the light. It's hard to comprehend to me, to people, to understand how much the community has sacrificed after the case, how much advocacy and kind of was done in the community to continue supporting people, how much has been lost. And this was done as people were coming to the realizations of losing their jobs, of battling to provide, to continue education for their kids, to provide care for the elderly and disabled family members and partners. The realities of forcing themselves to return to work because they had no leave and they were in desperate need of finances. And on top of all of that, on top of the trauma, on top of all that situation, we then took the mantle to try to advocate for our community. And we were met with silence. The last day that I had kind of gone, I had read this statement that was written by a number of residents. It was based around this idea of some accountability, and it was requests for basic information. And I read it out to the DHHS representative, the person who was in charge of this meeting, and I was surrounded by CoHealth and big polls that I'm entirely scared of, yeah? So imagine, for me, who has a apparent fear, who literally throws up before going to these meetings, completely fearful of cops, surrounded in a command center by cops. So I make my peace and walk into this building and read this statement. This is after the death of an elderly gentleman in our building, and I was ignored. And it was a basic request for information. It was a basic request to understand what were the strategies to prevent COVID from spreading. It was a basic request to understand what were the measures and the decisions that were made to open up common areas, because I had pleaded and brought parents and brought mothers in to plead with them, to explain to them their fear of using the laundries, that they are not fortunate enough to have laundries as some others, that they have young kids and are fearful of leaving their apartment. For the sheer reality to provide us some miracle of trust or accountability, so I can kind of translate that, provide that to those who are more in desperate need than myself. And we were ignored. I was classified, like many others, as not speaking for the community, not being truthful. All that was sacrificed. All of it. And for what? It's like nothing, to be honest. All the trauma that has occurred, all the destroyed lives, I hope it was worth it. someone. So yeah, so to me, it's, I'm still trying to understand what happened, to be honest, as many others do. I think I'll be haunted by it for years to come.
I had the opportunity earlier to chat with deaf disability rights advocate Jodie Barney over email. Her responses here are voiced by a 3CR volunteer.
Hi, I'm Jodie Barney. I'm a proud Birrugaba Yurungan woman from Queensland. Before I go any further, I wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which I'm yarning on, the lands of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge all First Nations mob listening in today.
What were your first thoughts when you found out about the Victorian government's public housing tower shutdown?
Well, I found out about the tower's shutdown by a very frantic mother who resides with her children in the public housing tower. My thoughts were, how will this mother cope? Also, the many others, 12 families, all together will cope with the restrictions and limited access to supplies, understanding of the restrictions, and importantly, the safety of them all.
You said to media at the time that 12 First Nations families with disabilities were caught inside Flemington's public housing towers. How did you come to know and make contact with them?
I've known the 12 families for many years, had been working with them in various projects in supporting their access to schools, employment, and importantly, the NDIS. I've been lucky enough to be invited into their homes and lives in providing culturally appropriate access to services and advocacy.
What were the main concerns and fears of these First Nations families with disabilities, and what did they need?
The families' needs varied, but common concerns was the impact of restrictions on family members with disabilities, not having PPE gear, and not enough money to feed everyone at home. There were safety concerns with family members not understanding the rules and leaving the house and be arrested.
How did you assist them and other residents with disabilities?
I assisted in many ways. Some families needed just social interactions and would yarn with them on FaceTime, Messenger chat, etc. I also assisted in providing food, making sign language videos to many who were nonverbal, doing sessions on mob with disabilities and coronavirus. However, cooking over 800 meals between March and November was the highlight for me. Using my skills to provide a good home-cooked feed for community in need was important to me.
Finally, in your view, what should happen to prevent this ever happening again and to ensure disabled people have what they need in emergencies?
Prevention is always better than cure. These times have been difficult for millions of people worldwide. We as global citizens see the impact of the coronavirus as a shared community, as it does not discriminate. I would like to see a stronger representation of First Nations people with disabilities and advocates to inform the government of our needs during pandemics and statewide emergency management. This will need to be a paid advisory committee that is chaired by a First Nations person with all First Nations people and diversity being fully included in the process.
Southeast Mutual Aid are an informal group of volunteers who have been sourcing and distributing resources to multiply marginalised members of communities in the southeastern suburbs, predominantly African, many of whom are disabled or immunocompromised. I asked if they could share two things that the pandemic revealed about the situation for disabled people in the southeast and what things would improve their material well-being if instituted tomorrow.
Two things that the pandemic has revealed about the situation for disabled people in the southeast include: one, those from refugee backgrounds that are multiply marginalized really don't exist. In other words, the lower you are in the racial hierarchy, the more deliberately invisibilized you are. And the abandonment is not just by the state, but also by their own communities, who often resent them, who see the DSP pennies as some sort of advantage or privilege, not understanding how complex care is. But also folk not knowing or having the means to know what their diagnosis is, makes it even harder to access the right services or care, meaning they're not able to even get their needs met.
Mm-hmm. And also another thing is there is a dire need for educating people in the Southeast about their rights and what those rights are, and to also like really ingrain into people that they're deserving of life and care and to be treated like decent human beings irrespective of them being Africans or having other marginalized identities or disabilities and etc. Mm-hmm. Materially deprived poor Africans from refugee backgrounds very often do not advocate for themselves. And even when one offers to advocate for themselves, and this is something that we've seen with Southeast Mutual Aid, is that they oftentimes fear that there will be repercussions from them trying to like advocate for themselves. And these repercussions can be things along the lines of like, you know, being deported or abandoned and losing the very bare minimum that they've got. So because of that fear, it prohibits them and hinders them from thinking that they do have the right to fight or the right to question or the right to disagree with whatever decision that Centrelink has taken or NDIS has taken or the employment services has taken, and even like the kind of care that they're getting, which oftentimes is really, really not sufficient. And because of the fear that they have, and also like because of them not being able to even know like what rights that they have, not being able to know that there are places that can hold people like Centrelink accountable, or that if one job agency is not meeting their needs, that they're able to seek another one. Because of lack of education around those things, they don't often try to question things or try to like allow themselves to feel like anger and the feelings that one will feel if they're being neglected or injustice is being done upon them. And I think also due to things like barriers in language and also like complicated relationship with authority, especially back home and things like that, all these things play into the fact that they oftentimes don't try to like negotiate or they don't try to disagree with whatever decision that has been made. There has been like hundreds of people who get a job seeker payment instead of DSP, and that is because they don't actually know that that payment exists and it's for them.
Two changes we feel that would improve material well-being for folks with disability if instituted tomorrow for us would include: one, not questioning their disability and not demanding them to have to continually prove their disability, especially because some of them have disabilities that they do because of medical malpractice from doctors and hospitals that they no longer have access to. And if you're born overseas or in refugee camps, then you don't have the ability to materially prove your disability because the papers don't exist. Who gets to decide what is a disability versus a medical condition to a disabled person?
And also I think another thing will be translation and just like language, but really conscious, deliberate and engaging, meaningful translations. Especially really important for the translators that get contacted by state services often to like go through some sort of training where they're being put in a situation or in a position to really examine their classism and their ableism and their afrophobia that they have. Because oftentimes, like, translators are the main cause of friction. They cause more harm than good. They don't, like, often refuse to act as a bridge between the services and the people. And often because of their investment in classism and ableism and both, they oftentimes see these disabled, marginalized Africans as being undeserving of care and unworthy. And so they don't really engage meaningfully with them. And so because of that, a lot of people in community, there has been situations where they've been charged for things like being asked to pay back money to Centrelink or being penalized for something to do with them not providing the right information. And this is because it was not communicated to them and it was not deliberately communicated to them, because the people that get engaged are harmful to them.
You've been listening to Anti-Blackness and COVID-19. Stay tuned for more Disability Day programming.